The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the second reading of Camino Island by John Grisham. I'm Rosina Chevalier. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. A team of five men carry out a theft of original F. Scott Fitzgerald's manuscripts from the Princeton University Library. They set off smoke bombs and firecrackers in one of the dorms as a diversion and drill through doors and locks to get to the papers. They think they are in the clear, but one left behind a drop of blood when he nicked himself. The FBI is after him now. Now we continue with Camino Island. The booze helped, but sleep was difficult for all four of them. Early the following morning, as Denny cooked eggs and bacon and guzzled black coffee, Mark sat at the counter with a laptop, scanning headlines from up and down the East Coast. "Nothing," he said. "Plenty of stuff about the ruckus on campus, now officially labeled as a prank, but not a word about the manuscripts." "I'm sure they're trying to keep it quiet," Denny said. "Yes, but for how long?" "Not long at all. You can't keep the press away from a story like this. There'll be a leak today or tomorrow." "Can't decide if that's good or bad." "Neither." Trey walked into the kitchen with a freshly shaved head. He rubbed it proudly and said, "What do you think?" "Gorgeous," said Mark. "Nothing helps," said Denny. None of the four looked the same as they had 24 hours earlier. Trey and Mark had shaved everything, beard, hair, eyebrows. Denny had gone from sandy blonde to dark brown. Jerry was a soft ginger. All four would be wearing caps and glasses that changed daily. They knew they had been captured on video, and they knew about the FBI's facial recognition technology and its capabilities. They had made mistakes, but their efforts to remember them were rapidly diminishing. It was time to get on with the next phase. There was also a cockiness that was the natural after-effect of such a perfect crime. They had first met a year earlier when Trey and Jerry, the two felons and the most experienced, had been introduced to Denny, who knew Mark, who knew Ahmed. They had spent hours planning and plotting, arguing about who would do what, and when was the best time, and where would they go afterward. 100 details, some huge, some tiny, but all crucial. Now that the heist was over, all that was history. Before them now lay only the task of collecting the money. At 8 a.m. Thursday, they watched each other go through the sat-track ritual. Ahmed was alive and well, all present and accounted for. Jerry and Mark said goodbye and drove away from the cabin, away from the Poconos, and 4 hours later entered the outskirts of Rochester. They had no way of knowing the sheer number of FBI agents patiently waiting and watching for the 2010 Toyota pickup truck leased 3 months earlier. When Jerry parked near his apartment, hidden cameras zoomed in on him and Mark as they nonchalantly walked across the parking lot and climbed the stairs to the third floor. The digital photos were instantly streamed to the FBI lab in Trenton. By the time Jerry kissed Carol hello, the photos had been matched to the frozen shots taken from the Princeton Library surveillance videos. The FBI's imaging technology nailed Jerry, or Mr. Gerald A. Steengarden, and it verified the identity of Mark as the imposter who borrowed the name of Professor Neville Manchin. Since Mark had no criminal record, He had no data in the National Crime Network. The FBI knew he was in the library. They just didn't know his name. But it wouldn't take long. The decision was made to watch and wait. Jerry had already delivered Mark. Perhaps he could give them another one. After lunch, the two left the apartment and returned to the Toyota. Mark was carrying a cheap maroon nylon gym bag. Jerry was carrying nothing. They headed downtown, and Jerry drove at a leisurely pace, careful to obey all traffic laws and steer clear of any policeman. They were watching everything. Every car, every face, every old man sitting on a park bench hiding behind a newspaper. They were certain they were not being followed, but in their business, one never rested. They could neither see nor hear the helicopter hovering benignly in the distance, following them 3,000 feet in the air. At the Amtrak station, Mark got out of the truck without a word, grabbed his bag from the back, and hustled along the sidewalk to the entrance. Inside, he bought an economy ticket for the 2:13 train to Penn Station in Manhattan. As he waited, he read an old paperback edition of The Last Tycoon. He was not much of a reader, but was suddenly obsessing over Fitzgerald. He suppressed a grin when he thought of the handwritten manuscript and where it was now hidden. Jerry stopped at a liquor store for a bottle of vodka. As he left the store, three rather large young men in dark suits stepped in front of him, said hello, flashed their badges, and said they'd like to talk. Jerry said no thanks. He had things to do. So did they. One produced some handcuffs, another took the vodka, and the third went through his pockets and removed his wallet, keys, and sat track. Jerry was escorted to a long black Suburban and driven to the city jail less than 4 blocks away. During the short drive, no one said a word. He was placed in an empty cell, again without a word. He didn't ask. They didn't offer. When a city jailer stopped by to say hello, Jerry said, "Say, man, any idea what's going on here?" The jailer looked up and down the hall, leaned closer to the bars, and said, "Don't know, pal, but you sure have pissed off the big boys." As Jerry stretched out on the bunk in the dark cell, he stared at the dirty ceiling and asked himself if this was really happening. How in hell? What went wrong? As the room spun around him, Carol answered the front door and was greeted by a half dozen agents. One produced a search warrant. One told her to leave the apartment and go sit in her car, but not to start the engine. Mark boarded the train at 2 o'clock and took a seat. The doors closed at 2:13, but the train didn't move. At 2:30, the doors opened, and two men in matching navy trench coats stepped on board and looked sternly at him. At that awful moment, Mark knew things were deteriorating. They quietly identified themselves and asked him to step off the train. One led him by the elbow while the other grabbed his bag from the overhead rack. Driving to the jail, they said nothing. Bored with silence, Mark asked, "So, fellas, am I under arrest?" Without turning around, the driver said, "We don't normally put handcuffs on random civilians." "Okay, and what am I being arrested for?" "They'll explain things at the jail." "I thought you boys had to name the charges when you read me my rights. You're not much of a criminal, are you? We don't have to read you your rights until we start asking questions. Right now, we're just trying to enjoy some peace and quiet." Mark clammed up and watched the traffic. He assumed they had nabbed Jerry. Otherwise, they would not have known he, Mark, was at the train station. Was it possible they had grabbed Jerry and he was already spilling his guts and cutting deals? Surely not. Jerry had not said a word, had not been given the chance. At 5:15, he was fetched from the jail and taken to the FBI office a few blocks away. He was led to an interrogation room and placed at a table. His handcuffs were removed and he was given a cup of coffee. An agent named McGregor entered, took off his jacket, took a seat, and began chatting. He was a friendly type and eventually got around to the Miranda warnings. "Been arrested before?" McGregor asked. Jerry had, in fact, and because of this experience, he knew that his pal McGregor here had a copy of his rap sheet. "Yes," he said. "How many times?" "Look, Mr. Agent, you just told me I have the right to remain silent. I ain't saying a word, and I want a lawyer right now. Got it?" McGregor said, "Sure," and left the room. Around the corner, Mark was being situated in another room. McGregor walked in and went through the same ritual. They sipped coffee for a while and talked about the Miranda rights. With a warrant, they had searched Mark's bag and found all sorts of interesting items. McGregor opened a large envelope, pulled out some plastic cards, and began arranging them on the table. He said, "Got these from your wallet, Mr. Mark Driscoll. Maryland driver's license. Bad photo, but with plenty of hair and even eyebrows. Two valid credit cards. Temporary hunting license issued by Pennsylvania. More cards for the display. And we got these from your bag. Kentucky driver's license issued to Arnold Sawyer. Again, with lots of hair. One bogus credit card." He slowly produced more cards. "Bogus Florida driver's license, eyeglasses, and beard. Mr. Lutheran Banahan. And this really high-quality passport issued in Houston to Mr. Clyde D. Mazie, along with driver's license and three bogus credit cards." The table was covered. Mark wanted to vomit, but clenched his jaws and tried to shrug. "So what?" McGregor said, "Pretty impressive. We've checked them out, and we know you're really Mr. Driscoll. Address uncertain because you move around. Is that a question?" "No, not yet." "Good, because I'm not saying anything. I have the right to a lawyer, so you'd better find me one." "Okay." "Odd that in all these photos you got plenty of hair, even some whiskers, and always the eyebrows. Now everything's gone. You hiding from something, Mark?" "I want a lawyer." "Sure thing. Say, Mark, we haven't found any papers for Professor Neville Manchin from out at Portland State. Name ring a bell?" "A bell? What about a sledgehammer to the head?" Through one-way glass, a high-resolution camera was aimed at Mark. In another room, two interrogation experts, both trained in the detection of untruthful suspects and witnesses, were watching the pupils of his eyes, the upper lip, the muscles in the jaw, the position of the head. The mention of Neville Manchin jolted the suspect. When Mark responded with a lame, "I ain't talking, and I want a lawyer," both experts nodded and smiled. "Got him." McGregor left the room, chatted with his colleagues, then entered Jerry's room. He sat down, smiled, waited a long time, and said, "So, Jerry, still not talking, huh?" "I want a lawyer." "Sure, right. We're trying to find you one. Not very talkative, are you?" "I want a lawyer." "Your buddy Mark is far more cooperative than you are." Jerry swallowed hard. He was hoping Mark had managed to leave town on the Amtrak. Guess not. What the hell happened? How could they get caught so quickly? This time yesterday, they were sitting around the cabin playing cards, drinking beer, savoring their perfect crime. Surely Mark was not already singing. McGregor pointed to Jerry's left hand and asked, "You got a Band-Aid there. Cut yourself? I want a lawyer." "You need a doctor?" "A lawyer." "Okay, okay, I'll go find you a lawyer." He slammed the door as he left. Jerry looked at his wrist. It couldn't be possible. Shadows fell across the pond, and Denny reeled in his line and began paddling toward the cabin. As the chill off the water cut through his light jacket, he thought about Trey, and frankly, how little he trusted him. Trey was 41 years old, had been caught twice with his stolen goods, served 4 years the first time before escaping and 2 years the second time before going over the wall. What was so troubling about Trey was that in both cases he'd flipped, sang, ratted on his buddies for lesser sentences. For a professional, that was a cardinal sin. Of the five in their gang, there was no doubt in Denny's mind that Trey was the weakest. As a ranger, Denny had fought in wars and survived the gun battles. He'd lost friends and killed many. He understood fear. What he hated was weakness. At 8 o'clock Thursday evening, Denny and Trey were playing gin rummy and drinking beer. They stopped, pulled out their sat tracks, pecked in their numbers, and waited. Within seconds, Ahmed chimed in with a clear from Buffalo. Nothing from Mark or Jerry. Mark was supposed to be on a train, enduring the six-hour ride from Rochester to Penn Station. Jerry was supposed to be in his apartment. The next 5 minutes passed very slowly. Or perhaps they raced by. Things weren't clear. The devices were working, right? They were CIA quality and cost a fortune. For two to go silent at the same time meant, well, what did it mean? At 8:06, Denny stood and said, "Let's take the first few steps, pack our bags with the essentials, and plan to haul ass, okay?" "Got it," Trey replied, obviously concerned. They ran to their rooms and began throwing clothes into duffel bags. A few minutes later, Denny said, "It's 11 minutes after 8. I say at 8:20, we're out of here, right?" "Agreed," Trey said as he paused to look at his sat track. Nothing. At 8:20, Denny opened the storage room door and unlocked the gun safe. They stuffed the five manuscripts into two green army duffels, padded with clothing, and carried them to Denny's truck. They returned to the cabin to turn off lights and make one last frantic inspection. "Should we burn it?" Trey asked. "Hell no," Denny snapped, irritated at his stupidity. "That'll just attract attention. So they prove we were here. Big deal. We're long gone, and there's no sign of the books." They turned off the lights, locked both doors, and as they stepped off the porch, Denny hesitated a second so Trey could move a step ahead. Then he sprung, slapping both hands tightly around Trey's neck, his thumbs jammed into the cartoid pressure points. Trey, older, slightly built, out of shape and unsuspecting, was no match for the ex-ranger's death grip around his neck. He wiggled and flailed for a few seconds, then went limp. Denny tossed him to the ground and took off his belt. He stopped for gas and coffee near Scranton and headed west on Interstate 80. The speed limit was 75 miles per hour. His cruise control was on 68. He'd had a few beers earlier in the evening, but all was clear now. His sat track was on the console, and he glanced at it every mile or so. He knew by now that the screen would remain dark. No one would be checking in. He assumed Mark and Jerry had been nabbed together, and their sat tracks were being taken apart by some very smart people. Trey's was at the bottom of the pond, along with Trey, both waterlogged and already decomposing. If he, Denny, could survive the next 24 hours and get out of the country, the fortune would be his and his alone. At an all-night pancake house, he parked close to the front door and took a table with his truck in sight. He opened his laptop, ordered coffee, asked about Wi-Fi. The girl said of course and gave him the password. He decided to stay for a spell and ordered waffles and bacon. Online, he checked flights out of Pittsburgh and booked one to Chicago, and from there a nonstop to Mexico City. He searched for storage units that were climate-controlled and made a list. He ate slowly, ordered more coffee, killed as much time as possible. He pulled up the New York Times and was startled by the lead story, one posted about 4 hours earlier. The headline read, "Princeton Confirms Theft of Fitzgerald Manuscripts." After a day of offering no comments and suspicious denials, officials at the university had finally issued a statement confirming the rumors. On the previous Tuesday night, thieves had broken into the Firestone Library while the campus was responding to 911 reports of an active gunman. It was evidently a diversion, and one that worked. The university would not disclose how much of its Fitzgerald collection had been stolen, only that it was substantial. The FBI was investigating, and so on. Details were scarce. There was no mention of Mark and Jerry. Denny was suddenly anxious and wanted to hit the road. He paid his check, and as he left the restaurant, he dropped his Sat Track into a waste can outside the front door. There were no more ties to the past. He was alone and free and excited about the turn of events, but also nervous now that the news was breaking. Getting out of the country was imperative. That was not what he had planned, but things could not be lining up more perfectly. Plans, nothing ever goes as planned, and the survivors are the ones who can adapt on the fly. Trey was trouble. He would have quickly become a nuisance, then baggage, then a liability. Denny thought of him only in passing now. As darkness began to dissipate, he entered the northern sprawl of Pittsburgh. Denny slammed the door on any memory of Trey, another perfect crime. At 9 a.m., he walked into the office of the East Mills Secured Storage Operation in the Pittsburgh suburb of Oakmont. He explained to the clerk that he needed to store some fine wine for a few months and was looking for a small space where the temperature and humidity were controlled and monitored. The clerk showed him a 12-by-12 unit on the ground floor. The rate was $250 a month for a minimum of a year. Denny said no thanks. He wouldn't need the space for that long. They agreed on $300 a month for 6 months. He produced a New Jersey driver's license, signed the contract in the name of Paul Rafferty, and paid in cash. He took the key back to the storage unit, unlocked it, set the temperature on 55 degrees and the humidity at 40%, and turned off the light. He walked the hallways, taking note of the surveillance cameras, and eventually left without being seen by the clerk. At 10 a.m., the discount wine warehouse opened, and Denny was its first customer of the day. He paid cash for 4 cases of Rotgut Chardonnay, talked the clerk out of 2 empty cardboard boxes, and left the store. He drove around for half an hour, looking for a spot to hide, away from traffic and surveillance cameras. He ran his truck through a cheap car wash and parked by the vacuum machines. This side of paradise and the beautiful and damned fit nicely into one of the empty wine boxes. Tender is the Night and The Last Tycoon were placed in another. Gatsby got a box of its own, once the 12 bottles were removed and left on the rear seat. By 11 o'clock, Denny had hauled the 6 boxes inside the storage unit at East Mills. As he left, he bumped into the clerk and said he'd be back tomorrow with some more wine. Fine, whatever. The clerk couldn't care less. As he drove away, he passed rows and rows of storage units and wondered what other stolen loot could be hidden behind those doors. Probably a lot, but nothing as valuable as his. He drifted through downtown Pittsburgh and finally found a rough section. He parked in front of a pharmacy, one with thick bars over the windows. He rolled down his windows, left the keys in the ignition, left 12 bottles of bad wine on the rear floorboard, grabbed his bag, and walked away. It was almost noon on a clear and bright fall day, and he felt relatively safe. He found a payphone, called a cab, and waited outside a soul food cafe. 45 minutes later, the cab dropped him off at the departures ramp at Pittsburgh International Airport. He picked up his ticket, eased through security without a hitch, and walked to a coffee shop near his gate. At a newsstand, he bought a New York Times and a Washington Post. On the front page of the Post, below the fold, the headline yelled at him, "Two arrested in Princeton library heist." No photos and no names were given, and it was obvious Princeton and the FBI were trying to control the story. According to the brief article, the two men were picked up in Rochester the day before. The search was on for others involved in the spectacular burglary. While Denny waited for his flight to Chicago, Ahmed caught a flight from Buffalo to Toronto, where he booked a one-way flight to Amsterdam. With 4 hours to kill, he parked himself at the bar in an airport lounge, hid his face behind a menu, and started drinking. The following Monday, Mark Driscoll and Gerald Steengarten waived extradition and were driven to Trenton, New Jersey. They appeared before a federal magistrate, swore in writing that they had no assets, and were assigned counsel. Because of their affinity for fake documents, they were deemed flight risks and denied bail. Another week passed, then a month, and the investigation began losing steam. What at first had looked so promising gradually began to look hopeless. Other than the drop of blood and the photos of the well-disguised thieves, and of course the missing manuscripts, there was no evidence. The burned-out van, their escape vehicle, was found, but no one knew where it came from. Denny's rented pickup was stolen, stripped, and devoured by a chop shop. He went from Mexico City to Panama, where he had friends who knew how to hide. The evidence was clear that Jerry and Mark had used fake student IDs to visit the library several times. Mark had even posed as a Fitzgerald scholar. On the night of the theft, it was clear that the two had entered the library along with a third accomplice, but there was no indication of when or how they left. Without the stolen goods, the U.S. attorney delayed the indictment. Attorneys for Jerry and Mark moved to dismiss the charges, but the judge refused. They stayed in jail without bail and without saying a word. The silence held. 3 months after the theft, the U.S. attorney offered Mark a deal of all deals. Spill your guts and walk away. With no criminal record and with no DNA from the crime scene, Mark was the better choice to deal with. Just talk and you're a free man. He declined for two reasons. First, his lawyer assured him the government would have difficulty proving a case at trial, and because of this, he would probably continue to dodge an indictment. Second, and more important, Denny and Trey were out there. That meant the manuscripts were well hidden, and it also meant that retaliation was likely. Furthermore, even if Mark gave them Denny's and Trey's full names, the FBI would have trouble finding them. Obviously, Mark had no idea where the manuscripts were. He knew the locations of the second and third safe houses, but he also knew that in all likelihood, they had not been used. All trails became dead ends. Tips that had at first seemed urgent now faded away. The waiting game began. Whoever had the manuscripts would want money, and a lot of it. They would surface eventually, but where and when, and how much would they want? Chapter 2, The Dealer. When Bruce Cable was 23 years old and still classified as a junior at Auburn, his father died suddenly. The two had been feuding over Bruce's lack of academic progress, and things had gotten so bad that Mr. Cable had threatened more than once to cut young Bruce out of his will. Some ancient relative had made a fortune in gravel, and, following bad legal advice, had set up a scheme of misguided and complicated trusts that had strewn money over generations of undeserving kinfolks. The family had for years lived behind the facade of fine wealth while watching it slowly drip away. Threatening to mollify wills and trusts was a favorite ploy used against the young, and it had never worked. Mr. Cable, though, died before he made it to his lawyer's office, so Bruce woke up one day with the promise of a quick $300,000. A beautiful windfall, but not quite retirement money. He thought about investing it, and doing so conservatively might net him an annual return of between 5 and 10%, hardly enough to sustain the lifestyle Bruce was suddenly contemplating. Investing in a more daring way would be far riskier, and Bruce really wanted to hang on to the money. It did strange things to him. Perhaps the strangest was his decision to walk away from Auburn after 5 years and never look back. Eventually, a girl enticed him to a Florida beach on Camino Island, a 10-mile-long barrier strip just north of Jacksonville. In a nice condo she was paying for, he spent a month sleeping, drinking beer, strolling in the surf, staring at the Atlantic for hours, and reading War and Peace. He'd been an English major and was bothered by the great books he had never read. To protect the money and hopefully watch it grow, he considered a number of ventures as he roamed the beach. He had wisely kept the news of his good fortune to himself. The money, after all, had been buried for decades, so he was not pestered by friends offering all manner of advice or looking for loans. The girl certainly knew nothing about the money. After a week together, he knew she would soon be history. In no particular order, he thought about investing in a chicken sandwich franchise and some raw Florida land and a condo in a nearby high-rise and several dot-com startups in Silicon Valley and a strip mall in Nashville and so on. He read dozens of financial magazines, and the more he read, the more he realized he had no patience for investing. It was all a hopeless maze of numbers and strategies. There was a reason he'd chosen English over economics. Every other day, he and the girl wandered into the quaint village of Santa Rosa to have lunch in the cafes and drinks in the bars along Main Street. There was a decent bookstore with a coffee shop, and they fell into the habit of settling in with an afternoon latte and the New York Times. The barista was also the owner, an older guy named Tim, and Tim was a chatterbox. One day he let it slip that he was thinking about selling out and moving to Key West. The following day, Bruce managed to shake the girl and enjoy the latte by himself. He took a seat at the coffee bar and proceeded to prod Tim about his plans for the bookstore. Selling books was a tough business, Tim explained. The big chains were deep discounting all bestsellers, some offering 50% off, And now, with the internet and Amazon, folks, we're shopping at home. In the past 5 years, over 700 independent bookstores had closed. Only a few were making money. The more he talked, the more somber he became. Retail is brutal, he said, at least 3 times. And no matter what you do today, you got to start all over again tomorrow. Bruce admired his honesty, but questioned his savviness. Was he trying to entice a buyer? Tim said he had made decent money with the store. The island had an established literary community, with some active writers, a book festival, and good libraries. Retirees still enjoyed reading and spent money on books. There were about 40,000 permanent residents, plus 1 million tourists each year, so there was plenty of traffic. What was his price? Bruce finally asked. Tim said he would take $150,000 cash, no owner financing, with the assumption of the lease of the building. Somewhat timidly, Bruce asked if he could see the store's financials, just the basic balance sheet and profit and loss, nothing complicated. Tim didn't like the idea. He didn't know Bruce and thought the kid was just another 20-something loafing at the beach and spending daddy's money. Tim said, "Okay, show me your financials and I'll show you mine." "Fair enough," said Bruce. He left, promising to return, but got sidetracked by an idea for a road trip. 3 days later, he said goodbye to the girl and drove to Jacksonville to shop for a new car. He coveted a sparkling new Porsche 911 Carrera, and the fact that he could simply write a check for one made the temptation painful. He stood his ground, though, and after a long day of horse trading, he surrendered his well-used Jeep Cherokee for a brand new one. He might need the space to haul things. The Porsche could always wait, perhaps until he'd earned the money to buy one. With a new set of wheels and money in the bank, Bruce left Florida for a literary adventure that he anticipated more with each passing mile. He had no itinerary. He headed west and planned to one day turn north at the Pacific, then back east, then south. Time meant nothing. There were no deadlines. He searched for independent bookstores, and when he found one, he decamped for a day or two of browsing, drinking coffee, reading, maybe even lunch if the place had a cafe. He usually managed to corner the owners and gently poke around for information. He told them he was thinking about buying a bookstore and frankly needed their advice. The responses varied. Most seemed to enjoy their work, even those who were wary of the future. There was great uncertainty in the business, with the chains expanding and the internet filled with unknowns. There were horror stories of established bookshops driven out of business when large discount stores popped up just down the street. Some of the independents, especially those in college towns too small for the chains, appeared to be thriving. Others, even in cities, were practically deserted. A few were new and enthusiastically bucking the trend. The advice was inconsistent and wide-ranging, from the standard, "Retail is brutal," to, "Go for it, you're only 23 years old." But the one constant was that those giving advice enjoyed what they were doing. They loved books and literature and writers, the whole publishing scene, and they were willing to put in long hours and deal with customers because they considered theirs to be a noble calling. For 2 months, Bruce drifted across the country, zigzagging aimlessly in pursuit of the next independent bookstore. The owner in one town might know 3 others across the state, and so on. Bruce consumed gallons of strong coffee, hung out with authors on tour, bought dozens of autographed books, slept in cheap motels, occasionally with another bookworm he'd just met, spent hours with booksellers willing to share their knowledge and advice, sipped a lot of bad wine at signings where only a handful of customers showed up, took hundreds of interior and exterior photographs, took pages of notes, and kept a log. By the time his adventure was over and he was finished and tired of driving, he had covered almost 8,000 miles in 74 days and visited 61 independent bookstores, no two even remotely similar. He thought he had a plan. He returned to Camino Island and found Tim where he'd left him, at the coffee bar, sipping espresso and reading a newspaper, looking even more haggard than before. At first, Tim did not remember him, but then Bruce said, "I was thinking about buying the store a couple of months ago. You were asking $150." "Sure," Tim said, perking up only slightly. "You find the money?" "Some of it. I'll write a check today for $100,000 and $25,000 a year from now on." "Nice, but that's 25 short, the way I count. That's all I have, Tim. Take it or leave it. I found another store on the market." Tim thought for a second, then slowly shoved forward his right hand. They shook on the deal. Tim called his lawyer and told him to speed things along. 3 days later, the paperwork was signed and the money changed hands. Bruce closed the store for a month for renovations and used the downtime for a crash course on bookselling. Tim was happy to hang around and share his knowledge on every aspect of the trade, as well as the gossip on customers and most of the other downtown merchants. He had a lot of opinions on most matters, and after a couple of weeks, Bruce was ready for him to leave. On August 1, 1996, the store reopened with as much fanfare as Bruce could possibly drum up. A nice crowd sipped champagne and beer and listened to reggae and jazz while Bruce relished the moment. His grand adventure had been launched, and Bay Books, new and rare, was in business. His interest in rare books was accidental. Upon hearing the awful news that his father had dropped dead of a heart attack, Bruce went home to Atlanta. It wasn't really his home. He'd never spent much time there, but rather the current and last home of his father, a man who moved often and usually with a frightening woman in tow. Mr. Cable had married twice and badly and had sworn off the institution, but he couldn't seem to exist without the presence of some wretched woman to complicate his life. They were attracted to him because of his apparent wealth, but over time, each had realized he was hopelessly scarred by two horrific divorces. Luckily, at least for Bruce, the latest girlfriend had just moved out and the place was free from prying eyes and hands. Until Bruce arrived. The house, a baffling, cutting-edge pile of steel and glass in a hip section of downtown, had a large studio on the third level where Mr. Cable liked to paint when he wasn't investing. He had never really pursued a career, and since he lived off his inheritance, he had always referred to himself as an investor. Later, he'd turned to painting, but his oils were so dreadful that he'd been shooed away from every gallery in Atlanta. One wall of the studio was covered with books, hundreds of them, and at first Bruce hardly noticed the collection. He assumed they were just window dressing, another part of the act, another lame effort by his father to seem deep, complicated, and well-read. But upon closer observation, Bruce realized that two shelves held some older books with familiar titles. He began pulling them off the upper shelf, one by one, and examining them. His casual curiosity turned to something else. The books were all first editions, some autographed by the authors. Joseph Heller's Catch-22, published in 1961, Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead, 1948, John Updike's Rabbit Run, 1960, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, 1952, Walker Percy's The Movie Goer, 1961, Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, 1959, William Styron's The Confessions of Nat Turner, 1967, Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon, 1929, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, 1965, and J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, 1951. After the first dozen or so, Bruce began placing the books on a table rather than returning them to the shelves. His initial curiosity was overwhelmed by a heady wave of excitement, then greed. On the lower shelf, he ran across books and authors he'd never heard of until he made an even more startling discovery. Hidden behind a thick, three-volume biography of Churchill were four books. William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, 1929, Steinbeck's Cup of Gold, 1929, F. Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise, 1920, and Ernest Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms, 1929. All were first editions in excellent condition and signed by the authors. Bruce fished around some more, found nothing else of interest, then fell into his father's old recliner and stared at the wall of books. Sitting there in a house he'd never really known, looking at wretched oils done by an artist with an obvious lack of talent, wondering where the books came from, and pondering what he would do when Molly, his sister, arrived, and they would be expected to plan a funeral service. Bruce was struck by how little he knew about his late father. And why should he know more? His father had never spent time with him. Mr. Cable shipped Bruce off to boarding school when he was 14. During the summers, the kid was sent to a sailing camp for 6 weeks and a dude ranch for six more, anything to keep him away from home. Bruce knew of nothing his father enjoyed collecting other than a string of miserable women. Mr. Cable played golf and tennis and traveled, but never with Bruce and his sister, always with the latest girlfriend. So where did the books come from? How long had he been collecting them? Were there old invoices lying around, written proof of their existence? Would the executor of his father's estate be required to lump them in with the other assets and give them, along with the bulk, to Emory University? Leaving the bulk of the estate to Emory was something else that irked Bruce. His father had talked about it occasionally without giving too many details. Mr. Cable was of the lofty opinion that his money should be invested in education and not left for the children to squander. On several occasions, Bruce had been tempted to remind his father that he'd spent his entire life pissing away money earned by someone else, but squabbling over such matters would not benefit Bruce. At that moment, he really wanted those books. He decided to keep 18 of the best and leave the rest behind. If he got greedy and left gaps, someone might notice. He fit them neatly in a cardboard box that had once held a case of wine. His father had battled the bottle for years and finally reached a truce that allowed him a few glasses of red wine each night. There were several empty boxes in the garage. Bruce spent hours rearranging the shelves to give the impression that nothing was missing. And who would know? As far as he knew, Molly read nothing. And, more important, avoided their father because she hated his girlfriends. To Bruce's knowledge, Molly had never spent a night in the house. She would know nothing of her father's personal effects. However, 2 months later, she asked him on the phone if he knew anything about Daddy's old books. Bruce assured her he knew nothing. He waited until dark and carried the box to his Jeep. There were at least 3 surveillance cameras watching the patio, driveway, and garage. And if anyone asked questions, he would simply say he was taking away some of his own stuff, videos, CDs, whatever. If the executor of the estate later asked about the missing first editions, Bruce would, of course, know nothing. Go quiz the housekeeper. As things evolved, it was the perfect crime, if indeed it was a crime at all. Bruce really didn't think so. In his opinion, he should be receiving far more. Thanks to thick wills and family lawyers, his father's estate was wrapped up efficiently, and his library was never mentioned. Bruce Cable's unplanned entry into the world of rare books was off to a fine start. He plunged himself into the study of the trade and realized that the value of his first collection, the 18 taken from his father's house, was around $200,000. He was afraid to sell the books, though, afraid someone somewhere might recognize one and ask questions. Since he did not know how his father had gained possession of the books, it was best to wait, allow some time to pass for memories to fade. As he would quickly learn in the business, patience was imperative. The building was on the corner of 3rd and Main Street in the heart of Santa Rosa. It was 100 years old and originally built to house the town's leading bank, one that collapsed in the Depression. Then it was a pharmacy, then another bank, then a bookshop. The second floor stored boxes and trunks and file cabinets, all laden with dust and utterly worthless. Up there, Bruce managed to stake out a claim, clear some space, throw up a couple of walls, move in a bed, and call it an apartment. He lived there for the first 10 years. Bay Books was in business. When he wasn't downstairs peddling books, he was upstairs clearing, cleaning, painting, renovating, and eventually decorating. The bookstore's first month was August 1996. After the wine and cheese opening, the place was busy for a few days, but the curiosity began to wear off. The traffic slowed considerably. After 3 weeks in business, Bruce was beginning to wonder if he'd blundered badly. August saw a net profit of only $2,000, and Bruce was ready to panic. It was, after all, the high season for tourism on Camino Island. He decided to begin discounting, something the majority of independent owners advised against. Big new releases and bestsellers were marked down 25%. He pushed the closing time back from 7 to 9 and put in 15 hours a day. He worked the front like a politician, memorizing the names of the regular customers and noting what they bought. He was soon an accomplished barista. He could brew an espresso while hustling to the front to check out a customer. He removed shelves of old books, mainly classics that were not too popular, and put in a small cafe. Closing time went from 9 to 10. He cranked out dozens of handwritten notes to customers and to writers and booksellers he'd met on his coast-to-coast adventure. At midnight, he was often at the computer, updating the Bay Books newsletter. He wrestled with the idea of opening on Sunday, something most of the independents did. He didn't want to because he needed the rest, and he was also afraid of possible backlash. Camino Island was in the Bible Belt. One could easily walk to a dozen churches from the bookstore, but it was also a vacation spot, and almost none of the tourists seemed interested in Sunday morning worship. So, in September, he said to hell with it and opened at 9 a.m. Sunday, with the New York Times, Washington Post, Boston Globe, and Chicago Tribune hot off the press, along with fresh chicken biscuits from a cafe three doors down. By the third Sunday, the place was packed. The store netted $4,000 in September and October and doubled that after 6 months. Bruce stopped worrying. Within a year, Bay Books was the hub of downtown, by far the busiest store. Publishers and sales reps succumbed to his constant badgering and began to include Camino Island on author tours. Bruce joined the American Booksellers Association and immersed himself in its causes, issues, and committees. In the winter of 1997, at an ABA convention, he met Stephen King and convinced him to pop over for a book party. Mr. King signed for 9 hours as fans waited in lines that wrapped around the block. The store sold 2,200 copies of his various titles and grossed $70,000 in sales. It was a glorious day that put Bay Books on the map. 3 years later, it was voted best independent bookstore in Florida. And in 2004, Publishers Weekly named it Bookstore of the Year. In 2005, after 9 hard years in the trenches, Bruce Cable was elected to the ABA Board of Directors. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of Camino Island by John Gresham. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.